This lecture is brought to you by the virtual campus of the Reformed Baptist Seminary. For information on other courses or seminary programs, please contact us at virtual.seminary.org.
Well, brethren, we have come now to our third great reformer to take up, and that is John Calvin. And so just ask that you find your place in your notes in John Calvin. I should have given you a warning beforehand. Well, I want to just say some words by way of introduction, and even if you haven't found your place there, I'm sure you will in a moment. Calvin was a second-generation reformer. When Calvin was born in 1509, Luther was already giving lectures at the University of Erfurt, and Zwingli was immersed in his pastoral labors in Glarus. And when he was recruited to the Protestant cause in the early 1530s, Calvin inherited a tradition and theology hammered out by nearly two decades of controversy already. But this doesn't mean that Calvin came along merely in time to hang the pictures. God raised up John Calvin when the Reformation was at a crisis point. Luther had expected that as the first treatises burst upon the world, the papacy would crumble, the emperor would convene a true reforming council, the Jews and the Turks would be converted, and Christ would return, and the devil would be vanquished forever. But scarcely 10 years had passed before the Luther's apocalyptic optimism had turned to near despair, as he stood excommunicated by the Pope and banned by an emperor preparing to wage war against the Protestant princes. The Jews were once again turning a deaf ear to the gospel, and the holy jihad of the Turks had advanced to the very gates of Vienna. And even more distressful than these external threats were those forces that were rending the Protestant cause asunder from within. Disagreement between the Zwinglians and the Lutherans over the Lord's Supper, it widened rather than lessened after the Marburg colloquy. And many who had rallied around Luther when he first took his stand against the papal system were now defecting from the Wittenberg Pope, as Thomas Munster dubbed him, for the cause of the radical Reformation. And of course, all sides appealed to the Bible. Caspar Schwenkfeld, one of the spiritualist reformers, he observed that on the basis of the Bible, the papists damned the Lutherans damned the Zwinglians damned the Anabaptists, and the Anabaptists damned all the others. At this very moment, with Zwingli dead and Erasmus dying, the Romanists gearing up for the Counter-Reformation, and the Radical Reformation soon to be discredited by the bloody spectacle of Munster, God raised up a reticent Frenchman, John Calvin, to be the leader of the Reformed Protestantism and to be the great theologian of the Reformation. And what I want to do in the time that remains today is give something of a biographical sketch and try to intersperse it with some of his theological progress. And I think it'll be helpful in understanding Calvin. Also, I think it'll be helpful in understanding his doctrine of the church. We're not going to be able to give separate lectures of the doctrine of the church, but we'll be able to see how it was worked out in Geneva and some of his thinking concerning that doctrine. And so our first section has to do with the man and his work. And as we take this up, we want to look first of all at the man behind the myth. We've called Calvin the theologian of the Reformation, not only because we are persuaded that of the leading reformers, he came to conclusions that we usually deem to be the closest to the truth as taught in the scriptures, but also because of the sheer theological volume that came forth from his pen, and because of the fact that more than any of the other reformers, he gave systematic form to the doctrines of the Bible. One doesn't have to be from his own theological camp to recognize his theological greatness. In his own day, no less a person than Melanchthon denominated Calvin the theologian. When Karl Barth began his lectures on the theology of the reformers, he wrote of his struggles with coming to grips with the teaching of Calvin in a letter to his friend Edward Turniston. He said, "Calvin is a cataract, a primeval force, a demonic power, something directly down from Himalaya, absolutely Chinese, strange, mythological. I lack completely the means, the suction cups, even to assimilate this phenomenon, not to speak of presenting it adequately. What I receive is only a thin little stream, and what I could then give out is only a yet thinner extract of this little stream. I could gladly and profitably set myself down and spend all the rest of my life just with Calvin. And this greatness is itself one of the hindrances in the study of Calvin. Studies in Calvin are surpassed in number only by those of Luther. And a mere glance at the, quote, select bibliography provided in Williston Walker's biography, 77 pages of bibliography, it's enough to overwhelm the student just getting his feet wet in this subject, and to which class I put myself. Besides its intimidating effect, such greatness tends to create a mythology which obstructs an accurate perception of the facts. And hence, scholars who have attempted to reconstruct an accurate chronology and a true picture of the man and his work, they have been constrained to burden their works considerably with detailed arguments to prove their case. And it can kind of get tedious to wade through all of that. Accordingly, there are many areas of learned controversy with respect to various facets of Calvin's life and thought. Well, a man of such stature is sure to abound both in admirers and detractors. This has been so in an unusual way with Calvin. Cunningham, he asserts, indeed, it is probably true that no man whose time and talents were devoted exclusively to subjects connected with Christianity and the Church has ever received so large a share both of praise and censure. He has been commended in the strongest terms by many of the highest names, both in Christian and in general literature. But if he has received the highest commendation, he has also been visited with a vast amount of censure, the one being really, in the circumstances, just about as significant a testimony to his excellence and his influence as the other. Well, in the volume of the edition of his works published by the Calvin Translation Society, which contains his commentary on Joshua, which is the last commentary that Calvin wrote, a collection of testimonials commending Calvin's works from men of all ages, places, and opinions, including not only Calvinists, but also Arminians, infidels, statesmen, philosophers, and other men of letters, it fills over 100 pages. And footnotes just noted that, unfortunately, the Baker reprint of Calvin's works, which was formerly offered by the Calvin Translation Society, and now in two sets, Calvin's commentaries and Calvin's selected works, unfortunately, the modern editions have deleted this 100 pages of testimonials. Well, as far as we know, no other theologian has received this kind of praise. But Calvin is also one of the most hated men in history. Not only has his theology often been misrepresented, but his character has often been maligned. Attempts have been made to fasten arrogance, spiritual tyranny, intolerance, and persecution to his name. Most Christians know only two things about him. He believed in predestination, and he sent Servetus to the stake. And hence, as Pastor Walden observes, the history of Calvin's studies is the history of a battle royal between his advocates and his detractors. And this war began shortly after his death, and more than 400 years later is being waged with unremitting fervor. The slanderous treatment that he has often received is typified by the scurrilous attack on Calvin published by Jerome Bolzec in 1577, sometime after he had returned from Protestantism to the Roman Catholic fold. Bolzec portrayed Calvin not only as imperious and ill-tempered, but also as a drunkard, an adulterer, and a homosexual. Calvin's chronic sickness, he claimed, was an obvious evidence of the vindicatory justice of God. His being eaten with lice and vermin all over his body, a divine judgment for his heresy. And then, on the other hand, the extreme Calvin without warts is the classic seven-volume biography of Émile Dommerger. And while incontestably the most detailed study of Calvin's life ever written, Dommerger's Calvin is too good to be true, just as Bolzac's Calvin is too demonic to be human. He was, after all, just what Luther declared all Christians to be, at one and at the same time, both a sinner and a saint. Nevertheless, as the exaggerations from both ends of the spectrum have forced students of Calvin to clarify certain issues, the battle over Calvin has rendered its service. Several of the more recent biographies of Calvin reflect the benefits of this controversy, and I would commend T.H.L. Parker's biography and also William Bousma's biography of Calvin. And as these works are readily available, and it's not our present purpose to present a full-scale biography, we propose only to give a brief sketch of his life and his work before launching into a study of his theological contributions. And our survey is going to take note of three elements: his preparation, his conversion, and his mission. First place, we want to look at his preparation. As we consider his preparation, of course, you have to begin with his childhood. Jean Covin, that was his original name. Calvin comes from a Latinized form of his name, Calvinus. Jean Covin was born on the 10th of July, 1509, at Nyon, France. Unlike Luther's, his upbringing was from the beginning hospitable to ecclesiastical and social advancement. You remember Luther was a miner's son, but Calvin is born, so to speak, into the upper middle class. By 1497, his father, Gerard Covin, a shrewd man of affairs, had made successful application to become bourgeois, a free citizen. He was the administrative assistant to the Bishop of Nyon, and thus seems to have been impressed with the advantages of a clerical life to which he early devoted his promising son. If you're familiar with Luther's life, it's just the opposite. Luther's father's horrified that Luther would dedicate himself to be a monk. He almost disowns him because of that. But Calvin's father, he devotes his son to that. To this end, he placed Jean in the local grammar school, the Collège des Capets. You have to excuse my French. Just as my German is bad, I have a hard time talking like I'm clearing my throat continually. And my French, I have a hard time talking like I have a stuffed up nose continually. And so I can't pronounce a lot of these words very well. I admire some of these classical disc jockeys, that can give all these classical musicians and all these different languages and speak all these languages, but I don't have that talent. Well, through his connections with the bishop there at that school, he was also able to procure a benefice for his son when Jean was 12 years old. That would be financial backing for him to be in the ministry. And because of the holding of a benefice required entering of minor orders, this meant that Jean became a clerk, received the tonsure, and began the performance of ecclesiastical duties all at this young age. The income from this benefice was a kind of scholarship by which young Calvin, already a precocious student, was able to pursue his studies. His father was thereby enabled to place him in the Montmore household, where Jean shared a tutor with other members of the family. And all of this meant that in addition to his early ecclesiastical connections and tutorial training, young Calvin enjoyed the warmth of social contact with an aristocratic family. He dedicated his first book to a member of the Montmore family, declaring, "I owe you all that I am and have. As a boy, I was brought up in your home and was initiated in my studies with you. Hence, I owe to your noble family my first training in life and letters." And thus, though he once described himself as merely a man from among the common people, he was able to sit with ease at the tables of the great. This takes us now to his undergraduate studies at the University of Paris, 1521 to 26. And perhaps 1520 or 1521, you can look at Parker to get all the details. Jean Covin arrived with the Montmorents in Paris and began his formal training in the most famous university in Europe. And I might say that, interestingly, that one of the great engineers of scholastic excellence at that university was Jean Gerson, who was something of a mystic. But, you know, if you read that stuff on mysticism, you'll read about Jean Gerson. And if you read Osmond's Age of Reform, he speaks quite a bit about how the university was transformed, and there were humanist influences and nominalist influences and mystical influences in the, and it was, anyway, it was kind of like the cream of the crop of the universities. And at first, Calvin was enrolled in the Collège de la Marche, the equivalent of the college of a college prep school. And for a year, he perfected his knowledge of Latin grammar and syntax, which was absolutely essential for studies in the university, where all the courses were taught entirely in Latin. You thought you had it hard. Here he was taught by Mathurin Cordier, one of the greatest Latin teachers of the day, whose Grammatica Latina was still being used well into the 19th century. And years later, Calvin remembered his brilliant teacher and dedicated to him his commentary on 1 Thessalonians. When my father sent me, while yet a boy, to Paris, after I had simply tasted the first elements of the Latin tongue, Providence so ordered it that I had for a short time the privilege of having you as my instructor, that I might be taught by you the true method of learning in such a way that I might be prepared afterward to make somewhat better for proficiency. I derive so much assistance afterward from your training that it is with good reason that I acknowledge myself indebted to you for such progress as has since been made. This I was desirous to testify to posterity, that if any advantage shall accrue to them by from my writings, they shall know that it is in some degree originated with you. I might just say that this bore a lot of fruit in the writing style that he has. When you begin to read Calvin as opposed to Luther, you instantly begin to recognize excellency of expression and of diction and of command of the use of language, a refined way of stating things. And all of this, in God's providence, was being prepared in this early training in Latin and the languages and so forth that he had received. Calvin soon advanced to the Collège de Montaigu, where he undertook undergraduate studies. Usually 3 or 4 years of study were required before the student was issued a Master of Arts degree. Logic was the core curriculum. And upon conferral of the Master of Arts degree, students could undertake graduate studies in theology, law, or medicine. In Calvin's days at the Collège de Montaigu, or how you say it, Montaigu, which was famous for its stern discipline and bad food, may have contributed to his lifelong problems with indigestion and insomnia. Legend has it that during these years, Calvin's fellow students awarded him the nickname the Accusative Case, because of his penchant for censoring their morals. And though this has no factual basis, even Beza's adoring biography portrays him as a strict censor of everything vicious in his companions. But Calvin's correspondence during his days in Paris and later in Orléans showed that he was on intimate terms with a circle of friends with whom he shared deep mutual affection. And so, these letters, they reveal that the stoical, cynical, unfriendly Calvin, who was a loner, the enemy of all mankind, is a caricature of myth and not of history. And this is confirmed by the fact that many of Calvin's early companions eventually joined him at Geneva. If he turned everybody off, that wouldn't have been the case. Well, the two rulers of Montaigu in Jean Covin's day were an embodiment of severe Catholicism and extreme scholasticism. And no doubt, Tempete, the great whipper of the school boys at Montaigu, was an appropriate choice as principal in a school where the pupils were taught to search their consciences in preparation for the regular public confessional, where denunciation of one another was demanded, and where a weekly behavioral examination was conducted. The other schoolmaster, Berthier, was one of the most reactionary of the Roman Catholic theologians of his day, and he was and continued for some years to be the leader of the conservative Paris theologians, the watchdog who barked his warning when he scented any stranger who bit first and offered no apology afterwards. And guided by the criteria, not of the creeds of Christendom, not even by the statements of medieval councils, but of the narrowly parochial and thus inbred theology of late medieval Paris itself, he fancied himself the champion of the faith, fastening on any doctrines that were novel to him and settling the matter conclusively by calling them Lutheran. And thus, it was at Montaigu that Jean Covin began to acquire a distaste for scholastic theology, of which he later wrote, "You yourself know that it was mere sophistry, and sophistry so twisted, involved, tortuous, and puzzling, that scholastic theology might well be described as a species of secret magic. The denser the darkness in which one shrouded a subject, the more he puzzled himself and others with preposterous riddles, the greater his fame for acumen and learning." All of this is childhood and then his undergraduate studies at Paris. And now in the third place, we're still considering his preparation, the study of law at Orléans and Bourges. At this point, two significant changes took place, a change from the study of theology to law, and a change from conservatism to humanism. First of all, a change to law studies. After 1526, Calvin, and now his name begins to be called Calvin. Around this time, Calvin left the study of philosophy and theology behind, when at his father's behest, he moved to Orléans to take up a study of law. Calvin himself says that his father saw that his son was likelier to earn a better income as a lawyer than as a servant of the church, which was hardly a new discovery to a man who had all along been active in both worlds, but also perhaps a growing realization that one beholding the unsettled state of the church after it had begun to feel Luther's impact. He wondered, well, should I get my son in now, in the midst of all this turmoil? But another factor might have been at work in this decision, a legal quarrel between Gerard Covin and the cathedral chapter at Nyon. However, it came about, the contrast with Luther is striking. Luther, in defiance of his father, spurned a career in law that he might become a monk. Calvin, in obedience to his father, gave up the study of theology that he might become a lawyer. And Calvin's obedience was not half-hearted. In fact, he so enthusiastically threw himself into the study of law, first at Orléans, then at Bourges, that he soon was chosen to substitute as a kind of teaching fellow when the professors were absent from class. Calvin's legal training did not prove to be a waste of time, but provided him with a thorough knowledge of practical affairs, which soon would be a tremendous asset in his efforts to reshape the institutions of Geneva. As we're going to see later on, Calvin was a true statesman who mediated among the nations of that day. And so this background was of immense value to him. But then, at this time, there was also the change from conservatism to humanism. Whereas Montaigu was the bedrock of Catholic conservatism, Orléans was a hotbed of humanism, and even somewhat sympathetic to Lutheranism. So he goes to Orléans to study law. Now, training in law was traditionally dominated by expositions of medieval glosses on the Corpus Juris Civilis, compiled during the reign of Justinian. But the humanists were beginning to go straight to the corpus, bypassing the medieval Cretans. This had the tendency of removing the relevance of the corpus to contemporary law and making it a literal and historical source book. Remember, the whole nature of humanism, if you read that section, was get back to the sources. And hence, in Calvin's eyes, began to be open to the world of classical antiquity and to the study of ancient texts. Sometime after transferring to Bourges, his horizons were widened even further by the instruction he received from Melchior Wolmar in Greek. It's interesting that he had to leave the study of theology to get to the study of law to begin to study Greek. And at a time when Greek was still being linked with heresy, it represented the boundary between two worlds. And just in your footnotes, you'll notice, for instance, Cusard saying, "We are finding a new language called Grige. We must avoid it at all costs, for this language gives birth to heresies. Especially beware of the New Testament in Greek. It is a book full of thorns and prickles." So, anyway, this represented the boundary between two worlds, the study of Greek. But Calvin's tutelage under Wolmar did more than prepare for his future exegetical labors in acquainting with the Greek literature. It also brought him under the instruction of an evangelical from Germany. Isn't that amazing? That in God's providence, you would think, well, this was really a detour. I mean, you'd think if God was preparing a reformer, he'd kept him there in theology studies. He takes him over to law studies where he hears, in one way or another, some ideas concerning the gospel. Well, it is probable then that in 1531, Calvin returned to Orléans to complete his studies for his licentiate. And though this entitled him to his doctorate, it appears that he never accepted the proffered degree due to the substantial payment required. And now, as we consider his preparation, this brings us in the fourth place to Calvin as the wandering student, the years 1531 to 34. When his father died in 1531, Calvin felt free to forsake his legal studies for his real love, classical literature. And he moved back to Paris, and there he pursued his studies in Greek and perhaps made a start in Hebrew. In 1532, at the ripe age of 23, he published his first book, a commentary on Seneca's De Calmentia, in which he cited 56 Latin classical writers and 22 Greek, including references to all 33 works of Cicero, all the works of Horace, Virgil, and Ovid, scattered passages in Terence, Homer, Aristotle, Plato, and Plutarch. Some have supposed that Calvin was attracted to Seneca's determinism, and hence Calvin's doctrine of predestination. Others have speculated that his choice on clemency, which was the work of Seneca he was commenting on, was motivated by the desire to appeal to the king for clemency for the Protestants. So everybody tries to read something into it. But the book shows little interest in current religious debate. It is a masterpiece of erudition, and it seems motivated more by a desire for recognition as a scholar of note among humanist circles than anything else. But commercially speaking, it was a complete flop. Its first edition was its last, and Calvin had to pay for it himself, which was some discipline of God to keep him from making that his life, writing books just to impress people. But then, a second element that we need to comment on, and he's wandering years, from the middle of 1532 to the last half of 33, Calvin was back at Orléans, presumably teaching law. After assisting as chaplain in Lyon, he then returned in the fall to Paris. And so in the third place, during his fall in 1533, this day at Paris, a significant event in the life of Calvin transpired. On All Saints' Day, exactly 16 years to the day after Luther had posted his 95 Theses, Nicholas Kopp, a friend of Calvin and a rector of the University of Paris, delivered a convocation address which utterly shocked the dignified audience assembled for the occasion. It wasn't what we would call a hot gospel sermon. It borrowed enough from Luther and Erasmus to offend the defenders of Catholic orthodoxy. And therefore, Kopp was forced to flee for his life. Whether or not Calvin had written the sermon, it's a matter of debate. In any case, he was implicated in the event, and according to an old legend, escaped from Paris in the nick of time by being hoisted down out of a window on bedsheets while the police were knocking at the door, Calvin's Damascus deliverance. And then in 1534, a year of travel for Calvin, He's traveling with a student friend, Dutelle. This year began with several months in Angoulême, in which he probably made a start on his institutes. On May 4th, we find him resigning his benefices in Nyon. And though customary at age 25, if one was not going to pursue an ecclesiastical career, under Calvin's circumstances, it also indicates a decided break with the established church and a conviction that Reformation was best pursued from without rather than from within. Began to see a little bit of a difference here between him and Lefebvre, who tried to reform from within. Also during this year, he wrote his treatise, Psychopanikia, directed against the doctrine of soul sleep espoused by many of the Anabaptists. Interestingly, though not published until 42, the place and date identified by its preface is Orléans, 1534. Well, about a year after Kopp's address, some of the more zealous Protestants in Paris decided to make a public and frontal attack on the Mass. On October 17 or 18, a placard was posted all over the city with the title, Trustworthy Articles on the Horrible, Great, and Unbearable Abuses of the Papal Mass. It began, I invoke heaven and earth in witness of the truth against this pompous and proud papal mass by which the world, if God does not soon provide a remedy, is and will be totally desolated, ruined, lost, and laid low. For in the mass our Lord is so outrageously blasphemed and the people seduced and blinded, something which we ought no longer to suffer or endure. It went on to defend the unrepeatable nature of Christ's sacrifice and to denounce the, quote, miserable sacrificers, who if they were our redeemers, put themselves in place of Jesus Christ, unquote. The doctrine of transubstantiation has, quote, provoked the whole world to public idolatry. And the Mass has replaced the knowledge of Christ and the preaching of the gospel with bell ringing, anointings, chanting, ceremonies, candle lighting, censings, disguises, and such sorts of buffooneries as by which the poor world is like a flock of sheep, is miserably deceived, and by these ravening wolves eaten, gnawed, and devoured. End of quote. Although many of its arguments against the Mass are sound, its mode of expression and manner of distribution manifests misguided zeal. And over the next several months, King Francis had over 200 Protestants arrested and some 20 executed. Calvin and Dutelle fled, and in January 1535 arrived at Basel, a city that had been won to the Reformation by Ecolampadius. And here was the dwelling place of the humanist Erasmus, reformers Wolfgang Capito, Heinrich Bullinger, Guillaum Farel, Pierre Robert, and Nicholas Kopp. Well, such were the various strands of preparation God used to prepare this reformer. But now we come in the second place to Calvin's conversion. Because the question as to the time of his conversion has been complicated by multitudinous opinions of historians, we purposely refrain from identifying its precise place in the chronology that we just gave, and preferring, therefore, to take up this question under a separate heading. But our concern is not just identifying the time in which it took place, but also its nature. Now, what we've said so far concerning his preparation for his great work as a theologian and a reformer, it might give the impression that external factors in and of themselves were the molding influences that prepared him for his life's work. And therefore, it's vital that we pause to consider the spiritual work that was going on in his heart at this time. Thus, after giving our opinion as to the time of his conversion, we'll say a few things about its character. First of all, the time of Calvin's conversion. And for our purposes, we're going to limit our discussion to an examination of the two most common positions, that Calvin's conversion is dated around late 1532, that's the late date, after he completed his studies in law school. The other opinion, that Calvin's conversion took place around 1529, while he was still at law school. First of all, the late position. And this is represented by Williston Walker and apparently by Warfield. And the arguments are as follows. First of all, a momentous change seems to have taken place between the publication of De Clementia, that's his commentary on Seneca, in 1532, and the publication of the Institutes in 1536. And Warfield places great weight upon this consideration. I'm not going to read this long quote here, but he just emphasizes how it seems like he's so anxious about the popularity and the reception of it, and he seems like an unconverted man, all taken up with a worldly concern with this Clementia. But later on, and he begins to write the Institutes, we see a totally different approach to his studies, and he's not quivering with anxiety for the success of the book. He only wants to know whether God will be glorified. So that sums up what Warfield says. And so this argues, he thinks, for a change later on. And second argument is that it was not until May of 1534 that Calvin resigned his benefices in the Catholic Church. And if converted as early as 29, it seems odd that it took 5 years for a man of such resolute character to renounce participation in the benefits which had become such an abuse in the Catholic Church. And the third argument for the late date is that the first explicit evidences of his interest in the Reform movement are found in letters written in the fall of 33. But before you get totally convinced, let's hear the arguments for the other position, 1529. Commonly called the older position, this was presented earlier by Jean Cartier and has more recently been defended by Parker. And on balance, we think the arguments usually presented in its favor are more conclusive. First, the only extensive account Calvin gives of his own conversion favors this view. It's found in a preface of his commentary in the Psalms, and it runs as follows. My father intended me as a young boy for theology. But when he saw that the science of law made those who cultivate it wealthy, he was led to change his mind by the hope of material gain for me. So it happened that as I was called back from the study of philosophy to learn law, I followed my father's wish and attempted to do faithful work in this field. But God, by the secret leading of his providence, turned my course another way. First, when I was too firmly addicted to the papal superstitions to be drawn easily out of such a deep mire, by a sudden conversion, he brought my mind, already more rigid than suited to my age, to submission. I was so inspired by a taste of true religion, and I burned with such a desire to carry my study further, that although I did not drop other subjects, I had no zeal for them. In less than a year, all who were looking for a purer doctrine began to come and learn from me, although I was a novice and a beginner. Then I, who was by nature a man of the country and a lover of shade and leisure, wished to find for myself a quiet hiding place, a wish which has never yet been granted to me. For every retreat I found became a public lecture room. When the one thing I craved was obscurity and leisure, God fastened upon me so many cords of various kinds that he never allowed me to remain quiet, and in spite of my reluctance, dragged me into the limelight. Well, four factors deserve careful attention. First, Calvin places his conversion during the period of his studies in law. And hence his conversion could not have occurred prior to 25 or 26, nor later than 31. So this places it, you say, earlier than the 32 position. Second, it must have taken place sometime after initiating these studies, because he says that at first I followed my father's wish and attempted to do faithful work in this field, but God turned my course another way. So it was a little while after the beginning. After his conversion, he says that he didn't drop the legal studies, but he had no zeal for them, and this seems to indicate a conversion of 27 or later. So we're arguing for the earlier position, but not too early. And third, in less than a year after his conversion, Calvin says that others were coming to learn purer doctrine from him. And hence his conversion could not have taken place after the early part of 1530. Therefore, 28 or 29 seems most likely. In fourth place, Calvin remarks that at the time of his unexpected conversion, he was still firmly addicted to papal superstitions. And this is hardly consistent with a conversion after Calvin was already an established humanist, which would have been the later position, as his transition from conservatism to humanism seems to have taken place while he was at Orléans. His conversion must have taken place in 29 or earlier. And then a second argument for the earlier position in his second defense of the pious and orthodox faith concerning the sacraments in answer to the calumnies of Joachim Westphal, Calvin states that upon beginning to emerge from the darkness of papacy and after receiving a slight taste of sound doctrine, he read in Luther that Zwingli and Ecolampadius left nothing but empty figures in the sacraments and thus developed an immediate dislike for their writings. And all of this, he implies, happened before these men met at Marburg, 1529. And hence we have another indication that his conversion took place in 29 or earlier. Well, I've given some other arguments. I'm not going to take class time here to go through these other two arguments. But he writes to Bucer in 32, so you see some very early contact with that reformer. And in the fourth place, while he's at Orléans, he has close contact with two men that were known to have had reformed sentiments. And maybe we will read this here. He shared the propensity to work late at night with one of them, Pierre Robert, named Levitanus. The Midnight Oil is what it is, his nickname, a name which so stuck it eventually became his surname. And in 1528, out of fear of persecution in Orléans, Levitanus, he fled to Strasbourg. And though Calvin never explicitly connects him with his own conversion, Beza, along with others, does. For Beza says, having been acquainted with the Reformed faith by a relation named Peter Robert Olivet, he had begun to devote himself to the study of Holy Scriptures and from an abhorrence at all kinds of superstition to discontinue his attendance on the public services of the church. And even though Beza mistakenly says that this happens before Calvin went to Orléans, it is not impossible that Levitanus was influential in his conversion. And the other friend while he was there was Melchior Wolmar, Calvin's Greek teacher at Bourges, and probably before they left Orléans. And while at Orléans, Wolmar is already advanced in his commitment to Reformation principles beyond his master, Jacques Lefebvre. And not surprisingly, some have credited him with winning Calvin to the evangelical faith. Again, this is not impossible. Well, we can't be conclusive about the time of his conversion, but I think on balance, there's more favoring the earlier dating. But more important than pinpointing its time is the character of Calvin's conversion. Certain elements are common to every true biblical conversion, turning from sin and faith in Christ. But the characteristics of conversion experiences vary greatly. And this is not because true conversions to Christianity are eventually essentially different, but because the subjective consciousness of one differs from another. And all of the truths that cluster around the doctrine of salvation are not in every case apprehended in the same degree. Calvin relates his own conversion experiences in two ways. In his reply to Cardinal Sadoleto, he seems to tell us of his own experience through a general testimony that he places on the lips of those who come to the evangelical faith. In his preface and his commentary on the Psalms, which we cited earlier, he explicitly relates his own experience. And from these two documents, we learn the following about his conversion. First, Calvin's conversion was preceded by a period of struggle, dread, and doubt. No less than Luther, he had a traditional Catholic upbringing, and he must have been affected by the sense of anxiety and even terror which so dominated late medieval society. And that was the last area that we dealt with in the Unit 1 notes. I don't know if you've gotten there, religious anxiety. It's an important thing that we understand about that era. And as a very young boy, he had made a pilgrimage with his mother to Auerskamp Abbey, where he was granted the inestimable privilege of kissing the finger of St. Anne. Later, he presented a vivid picture of the kind of preaching he often heard. They indeed preached of thy clemency toward men, but confined it to those who should show themselves deserving of it. They moreover placed this desert in the righteousness of works, so that he only was received into thy favor who reconciled himself to thee by works. Nor meanwhile did they disguise the fact that we are miserable sinners, that we often fall through infirmity of the flesh, and that to all therefore thy mercy behooved to be the common haven of salvation. But the method of obtaining it, which they pointed out, was by making satisfaction to thee for offenses. And then the satisfaction enjoined was first of all, after confessing all our sins to a priest, suppliantly to ask pardon and absolution. And secondly, by good, to efface from thy remembrance our bad actions. And lastly, in order to supply what was still wanting, we were to add sacrifices and solemn expiations. And then, because thou art a stern judge and a strict avenger of iniquity, they showed how dreadful thy presence must be. Hence they bade us to flee first to the saints, that by their intercessions thou mightest be rendered exorable and propitious to us. This is from his reply to Cardinal Sadoleto's letter. And while there are many that are able to harden themselves against these kind of severe demands and threats, God did not allow this to take place in Calvin's soul. He goes on to say in this same account, "When, however, I had performed all these things, though I had some intervals of quiet, I was still far off from true peace of conscience. For whenever I descended into myself or raised my mind to thee, extreme terror seized me, terror to which no expiation nor satisfaction could cure. And the more closely I examined myself, the sharper the stings with which my conscience was pricked, so that the only solace which remained to me was to delude myself by obliviousness." So one feature of his conversion was that it was preceded by this period of anxiety over his soul. It doesn't seem, though, that there was the same kind of emotional volcanic eruptions that Luther had. But another feature, Calvin attributes his conversion to the sovereign work of God. Before his conversion, God's providence was at work. He said, "I followed my father's wish, but God, by the secret leading of his providence, turned my course another way." That's from the quote that we read earlier, how he turned him to study law. At the time of his deliverance, he was hopelessly sinking in the mire of superstition. And yet, he says, by a sudden conversion, he brought my mind, already more rigid than suited to my age, to submission. Now, Calvin had no idea that he was more pliable than others, or that he prepared himself by congruent grace. No, he says, God turned my mind. At one moment, he was stubbornly clinging to superstition, but before long, God had overwhelmed him with the truth. He says, "I was so inspired by a taste of true religion, and I burned with such a desire to carry my study further, that although I did not drop other subjects, I had no zeal for them." And his experience echoed in this sense Luther's. "I did nothing, the Word did it all." His doctrine of predestination, you see, wasn't the result of logical syllogisms. It grew out of his understanding of the Word of God, and it was known experiential from the beginning. God sovereignly came into his life to convert him. And a third motif in Calvin's conversion experience is expressed in his statement that God brought his mind to submission. Or, he used another word, to docility. As another translation rendered it. Now this word, docilitas, it might be rendered teachableness. Conversion in Calvin's case did not mean subduing the sensual passion. In his case, it meant a change of mind, being made teachable. He wanted to become a humble disciple, a learner, from Latin disco, to learn. One who sits at the feet of Jesus Christ. And this theme continues to resound throughout his teaching on the Christian life. The evidence of true piety and of the knowledge of God is docility. In his Catechism of 37, he says, "Whoever has been endowed with this piety dare not fashion out of their own rashness any God for themselves. Rather, they seek from him the knowledge of the true God and conceive him as he shows and declares himself to be." Commenting on Acts 18:22, he declares that true pietas cannot exist without this divine instruction. True religion and worship of God arise out of faith, so that no one duly serves God save him who has been educated in his school. But then there's a fourth feature of his conversion. His conversion was not dramatic or an earth-shaking event. Some that have mistaken his statement in his preface to the Psalms that by a, quote, sudden conversion, unquote, God brought his mind into submission. And others appealed to the description given in his letter to Sadoleto, like a flash of light, I realized in what an abyss of errors and in what chaos I was. And on this basis, one biographer has spoken of the violent manner of his conversion, concluding that it was unmistakably a Damascus. And as for the statement that his was a sudden conversion, it must be noted that subita may be translated either sudden, or it could also be translated unexpected. And that Calvin recognized this ambiguity appears in his commentary on De Clementia. So that commentary is useful for some purposes here. Subita, not only sudden, repentina, but also unexpected, in considerata. So this is a translation he recognizes as legitimate. In the context of Calvin's statement concerning his conversion, it seems to mandate inconsiderata, that his conversion was not the result of his own desires or intentions, but it took place unexpectedly. That seems to be the flow of thought that he has there. And whether it happened suddenly is irrelevant in this context. His mind, it was headed in one direction, and God unexpectedly turned it in the opposite direction. And the phrases that he uses to depict his conversion, they don't depict a volcanic eruption. He simply says, God turned my mind and brought it to docility. It was a taste of true religion, he says. You see, Calvin was no persecutor raging against the church. Rather, he was addicted to papal superstition, and he was in need of instruction. And what happened to him, it was accompanied by no noise. He simply was made teachable. That was his conversion. And again, the passage in his letter to Sadoleto, referring to a flash of light, it can be rendered differently and should be considered within its context. The whole sentence is translated by Henry Beveridge. It conveys a different impression. My mind, now prepared for serious attention, I at length perceived as if light had broken in upon me. That's a little bit different than the thundering lightning sort of imagery of the other translation. As if light had broken in upon me. Almost like just a window opened up and the light began to shine in my heart. And what a style of error I had wallowed, and how much pollution and impurity I had thereby contracted. The lights were turned on, you see, after a lengthy period of preparation. According to the context, a time in which he wavered between the authority of the Roman Church and the evangelical doctrine that he was beginning to hear. And this period of struggle he describes in very vivid terms. Offended by the novelty, I lent an unwilling ear, and at first, I confess, strenuously and passionately resisted. For such is the firmness or effrontery by which it is natural to men to persist in the course in which they have once undertaken. It was with the greatest difficulty I was induced to confess that I had all my life been in ignorance and error. One thing in particular made me averse to those new teachers, reverence for the church. But when once I opened my ears and allowed myself to be taught, you see this note of being taught, teachable, I perceived that this fear of derogating from the majesty of the church was groundless. Now, from one perspective, the transformation was stupendous. He was taken from darkness to light. From another standpoint, it was very unobtrusive. He was made receptive to evangelical truth. He doesn't go about emblazoning his sermons with his dramatic testimony. In fact, he's so reticent about his own conversion that in all the 58 volumes of his works, he records insufficient data to silence the debate even as to its date. And a comparison of the conversion experiences of Luther and Calvin is very instructive. It warns us against the practice of universalizing one experience, whether our own or that of one of the other great ones. Differences exist as to whether one's conversion has a dramatic character to it. And while the gospel is embraced by all who truly become Christians, God emphasizes different aspects of the truth as the need arises and as he sees fit. Luther's terrified conscience finds rest as he trusts in the righteousness of another. In Calvin's conversion, the intellectual element dominates. My mind was made teachable. He came to know God as his Father. And with the intellectual is the ethical. He had a taste of true piety. The God he came to know, he now loved and longed to glorify. The Calvin of unbending commitment to the glory of God and the Word of God was born anew during that time when he came to know God. So Calvin's experience, it ought to be of great encouragement to those who have never had a Luther-like experience of conversion. As Pastor Waldron has written, few of us have had Damascus Road experiences. We are prone to long for them. We're prone to have a sneaky suspicion that we can never be of great use without them. Calvin's conversion, for all we know, was very unimpressive, a small beginning. No man, however, has changed the face of Christianity more in 20 centuries. Then another thing needs to be added. Notice should also be given to the particular way in which the fruits of saving grace manifested themselves in the individuality of Calvin's character. Throughout the description of his conversion, he has protested his shy and retiring nature. He expressed his longing to live in a scholarly seclusion, in a quiet hiding place. It's impossible to truly understand or appreciate Calvin until we take into account this reticence. He was a shy fellow. If I were to think of who he was like in the scriptures, I would think more like Timothy, who needed to have Paul write to him and say, be strong of a sound mind. Don't be a wimp. And that tells the Corinthians to take to receive him. Don't make it too hard on this guy as he comes in among you. I think of Calvin being something like that. He wasn't a volcano. He wasn't a Peter. He wasn't a Luther. Nor was he like Zwingli, either eager to rush into the fray of battle. But rather, he was so shy, many considered him unsociable. But God didn't allow this aspect of character to go untouched. God worked on that aspect. For he goes on to say that in less than a year, all who were looking for a purer doctrine began to come and learn from me, although I was a novice and a beginner. Then I wished to find for myself a quiet hiding place, a wish which has never yet been granted me. God wouldn't let him be shy. For every retreat I found became a public lecture room, and the one thing I craved was obscurity and leisure, and God fastened on me so many cords of various kinds that he never allowed me to remain quiet, and in spite of my reluctance, dragged me into the limelight. And so the same way, the same God who subdued his heart to teachability, it also weaned him from reclusive attachment to the study. He was interested in preparing a reformer and a pastor as well as a scholar. One blessed result is the effect that this had upon his writings. Instead of having the musty smell of old books, they're invigorated by that freshness that comes from having real pastoral contact with people. Amen. Well, I was hoping to borrow another 5 minutes I'd been given, but this is really a good point for us to stop. So maybe we can borrow another 5 minutes later on. But maybe there's a question or two. Maybe we won't be able to, if we have enough questions. Yes.
Would you say that this characterization of Calvin's conversion is a good illustration of the essence of repentance, metaneo being a change of mind? Obviously it involves turning from sin to Christ in its full manifestation, but in its essence, at the very heart of the change of mind, mm-hmm. is not just objectively a change of mind regarding the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ, but it's subjectively this change of mind in terms of being made teachable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think
being
so.
Being made docile.
Yeah. Of course, a full-blown doctrine of repentance, as our confession has, does have the emotional element.
Yes.
That we grieve and sorrow over sin, 2 Corinthians 7. But the essence of it is that change of mind.
Yeah.
Mm. Of course, there are people in our day that in the whole lordship controversy, they want to just isolate it and say that's all it is. You think one thing, and then now you believe the gospel, believe Christ. And,
right.
And they say it's legalistic to have any thought that repentance should include sorrow or should include the volitional element or any of that.
Right. But it seems like the example of Calvin's conversion would even put that to death in terms of this docility. Because mm-hmm. it's not just an intellectual,
yeah.
you know, factual. It's being
yeah.
made docile and teachable.
Yeah, he wouldn't fit the campus crusade fellow that has the self on the throne still of his heart.
Right.
Christ is on the throne.
Yeah.
In this particular, it was intellectual. It was being made submissive as a student.
Right.
And that's a big issue. I mean, many times the biggest obstacle that people have to the gospel is intellectual.
Right.
And many at the roots of that intellectual is a stubbornness to submit to what God has to say.
Right. They suppress the truth in unrighteousness.
Yes. Any other observations? Well, this is, I think that, you know, as we deal with God's people, they're saved in different ways. And it's often people that are saved more like Calvin was that begin to have doubts, you know, about their salvation just
right.
because they didn't have some kind of a big moment that they can look back on. Mm. And so for them to realize that the variety of the way in which God works with his people. Mm. The other questions or observations? All right, well, it looks like we can take our lunch break and we'll reconvene and take up Calvin's mission. Mm.